on KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. 2020, what a year it has been. Who could have predicted at the start of the year, when the U.S. Senate was acquitting President Donald Trump of impeachment charges, or even when the Super Tuesday primary elections took place, that we were on the verge of a major global pandemic that would lead to widespread shutdowns? President Trump, who looked like he may win re-election on the strength of a stable economy and low official unemployment, saw his pathway to four more years derailed. His supporters railed against Black Lives Matter, refused to wear masks, insisted that the virus was a hoax, refused to believe Trump lost the election, and are now claiming that newly developed vaccines are dangerous. Today, as President-elect Joe Biden puts together a diverse cabinet that may or may not actually enact progressive changes, we'll survey the past year. My guest is Arun Gupta, who is an investigative journalist written for The Washington Post, The Nation, Raw Story, The Intercept, The Guardian, and Jacobin. He's also a regular news correspondent for Rising Up with Sonali. Welcome to the program, Arun.
Great to be with you, Sonali.
So more than 300,000 Americans dead this year, a figure that we couldn't have even imagined 10 months ago, which really ought to be, of course, the biggest news, but it is competing with so much other news. I want to start first with the thing that I mentioned at the top, which was that President Trump was impeached by the House last year around this time. And then, of course, there wasn't much chance that he was actually going to be convicted by the Senate. And we saw that Senate acquittal mark the beginning of this year. And Trump thought this was going to be his year to, you know, sailing to another 4 years. But that particular acquittal, I suppose, just couldn't have indicated to him or to us what would end up happening, right?
There's simply no way to predict it. And I think this is a very important lesson that political activists need to take forward, because I often find a very deterministic attitude among a lot of organizers, intellectuals who think they have journalists who think they have everything figured out and they know what's going to happen. With the impeachment, there was this attitude like, oh, well, you know, it doesn't matter, he's going to be acquitted. But the reality was the Democrats had no choice. They made the right call. If for no other reason, if they didn't go through the impeachment process, he was going, you know, and which was over him trying to rig the elections to get to pressure Ukraine to bring a case against Hunter Biden. He was going to use any number of other countries to do the same thing. Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Russia, Israel, who knows who would he have been calling on the phone to try and get them to interfere in the election. But, you know, and as we've seen, I think it was pretty clear that he was going to win. It's the coronavirus is what really defeated him. And that should be a sobering thought. And it should even be also more sobering, the fact that he nearly won. In 2016, if I have my numbers right, I believe he lost the three key states of Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, or rather he won those by about 80,000 votes. That's how he defeated Hillary Clinton in 2016. This time he lost Georgia, Wisconsin, and I forget what the third, Arizona. By something like 45,000 votes, which is so basically 1 in 4,000 votes was the difference between him winning and losing, despite the 300,000 dead, despite ethnic cleansing, the refugee ban, Muslim ban, concentration camps, refugee camps, despite the severe economic downturn, he's still nearly won. And that needs to be at the forefront of everyone's mind, because frankly, I think the Biden administration is going to be a disaster.
So we had this pandemic unfold, and immediately it exposed a number of things. One was, of course, just the failures of our capitalist system with so few guardrails in place. The fact that we have no whole nationalized healthcare system, the fact that when you have crises like these, you absolutely need government intervention, anathema to the libertarian streak, especially among our Republican colleagues. All of these things came into stark focus, and also the massive skepticism toward basic science. Recently, we heard about how the CDC had been so deeply politicized by two Trump appointees who came out as whistleblowers, although they no longer work there, but they revealed the extent to which that once vaunted institution was so politicized. So we saw all of these things come to a head that, you know, this coronavirus exposed these massive fissures in our government, laid them bare for all to see, right? I mean, coronavirus almost broke America.
Yeah, I think that's very, very true. And, you know, coronavirus doesn't discriminate, but society does. And so what we saw, what we've seen is a mapping of how coronavirus affects the country. It's bought into relief. I liken it to, you know, basically like an old plaque where people do etchings, where they put a piece of paper to reveal what's underneath and where you can see much more clearly. And that's what coronavirus has done. The fact that African Americans, Native Americans have died at basically a 2-to-1 rate as white Americans and Latinx, same, nearly almost 2-to-1. Is the result of structural racism that operates in thousands and thousands of different ways. You know, most dramatically, it operates because people of color tend to be on the lower end of the income and wealth scale because of structural racism. So they are in these frontline jobs. They tend to live in bigger households. They tend to use public transportation more. They have less opportunity and, you know, less money to get everything delivered. All the healthcare issues in terms of access, distrust, racism within the healthcare system. And so it is just absolutely unconscionable what we've seen, just this mass killing. And I think one of the most appalling things really is a lot of the media coverage. It is beyond just galling that why do we not see everyday headlines that Republicans are in effect trying to create a public health disaster, and they're succeeding. 3,600 dead on Wednesday, and 245,000 infections, which at a 1.7% mortality rate means in a few weeks that's going to be 4,100 deaths. Why aren't we seeing the newspapers and media saying every day Republicans are causing this absolute disaster because they can get political advantage from it? That's what they did during the Obama years. They cause economic damage for political advantage. Now they're causing this horrific death toll for political advantage.
Going back to what we surveyed earlier this year, another thing that would have been hard to predict was the way in which the police killing of George Floyd sparked a new national uprising, a new chapter of the Black Lives Matter movement, similar to what we saw after Mike Brown was killed in Missouri. And it, you know, the pandemic wasn't able to stop this huge wave of national protest. How significant was that? It would seem to go so much further than what we've seen previously, in as much as a much broader swath of American society finally understood what Black Americans have been saying for so long.
To be honest, in my perspective, I think it's very much a mixed bag, right? You know, in terms of like, how do we understand this historically? So on the one hand, you have these absolutely phenomenal, inspiring, massive protests, just this upsurge. And it shows kind of this latent, you know, liberatory left potential that exists in America, this, you know, that there is a huge swath of the public that wants, that is desperate for social justice. And, you know, it's not an accident that this massive upsurge happened during the pandemic. First of all, you know, George Floyd's last words, "I can't breathe," which is the coronavirus is a respiratory disease. You know, people are dying because they can't breathe. Black Americans are dying from it because they can't breathe. But it ignited all the anger and frustration. You know, we saw this brief moment where Trump started to take the pandemic seriously when his real estate friend from Queens died of the pandemic in March. But when it became clear that it was disproportionately affecting African Americans, then suddenly the script completely flipped. And Trump was calling for reopening. Remember where everything was supposed to be open again by Easter and the reopen rallies. And so I think it ignited this tremendous amount of frustration. And we saw these shifts in attitude, you know, in terms of a majority of Americans finally getting behind and understanding that police, there is systemic racism, that there needs to be deep reaching radical reforms within policing. But we've also run into the problems, the historic problems of the left and the lack of institutional capacity. And so all these calls for police to cut police budgets have essentially foundered. You know, in all these cities and states, all these liberal cities and states, California, New York, DC, Seattle, Portland, only minimal changes have been made. And in fact, there have been calls for, including from Biden, for increased funding, you know, that, oh, somehow the problem is they don't have enough funding, that they need to be trained better.
And of course, former President Obama saying a snappy slogan like defund the police does more harm than good.
Yeah, it's completely absurd in terms of this kind of like attitude that somehow calling for an end to a radical reform of an institution that was founded as slave patrols that is the source of so much violence, systemic violence, is a bad idea.
What was interesting also was that you had this moment where a majority of Americans, including white Americans, realized that there was a deep systemic racism in the country, symbolized by police brutality. And then the propaganda started kicking in, the Fox News narrative around the supposed looting and violence and the thugs that were, you know, were turning Black Lives Matter into a movement that was about violence. And then, of course, you had the federal troops being deployed to Portland, and you had Seattle, and you and I talked about the autonomous zone in Capitol Hill, Seattle, and you had this narrative that sort of upended at least the large white support for Black Lives Matter, which I think was also an interesting exercise this past year in how effective right-wing propaganda can be, right?
Yeah, I think that's very true. You know, certainly a big part of the problem is not just the right-wing propaganda, but how many liberals buy into the right-wing propaganda? Because I was hearing it, you know, I went up to the Capitol Hill occupied protest. It was called Autonomous Zone. Then they changed the name in Seattle because they were saying, we're not trying to secede from the U.S. So I went up there. I was also in Portland when the federal occupation of the courthouse was going on, and just the extreme violence and street battles that were happening every night. And I was hearing from a lot of liberals about their concern was about protester violence, about, you know, broken windows and arson and looting and all that. And I think this gets back to something very deep in American history, where there is more concern for property than people's lives. And this is, of course, embedded in the U.S. Constitution from the beginning, you know, that this, the Constitution is ultimately, it's about the rights of commerce, you know, that this is what the federal government is doing. It has control and regulating commerce. That's what the First Amendment fits into. But at the same time, there was, of course, the three-fifths clause, you know, that Black lives were only worth three-fifths of those of white lives. And we saw this really, I think, crystallize early on in the George Floyd protests, when there was a newspaper editor in Philadelphia who wrote a headline that said, "Building Lives Matter," right? And he was forced to resign over this, because what it says is that property mattered more than people's lives. Every single target in the country can burn, and that is not going to bring back George Floyd. And the problem is that a lot of liberals don't understand that, that they think that property is somehow more important. And we have to remember, the only reason people cared, if we go back to the week where George Floyd was killed, of course, there were two incredible incidents that same day. One was George Floyd being killed. The other was the Central Park incident with the African-American burner, Chris Cooper, and the white woman, Amy Cooper, who called the police on him, claiming that that he was threatening her, which everyone could see was false. But what really set off the national protests was the burning down of the police station in Minneapolis. If you go back and look at the coverage, that's when things exploded nationwide. So it was the property destruction that inspired people to go out into the streets, you know. And the fact of the matter is that liberals don't listen. Where were they when Colin Kaepernick was taking the knee? They were silent as the right was railing against them. You know, there's also this history of white Americans generally, there's polling data by Gallup that goes back decades. A significant majority of people support protests, but if they find out it's Black people protesting, then support for white support for the protest falls dramatically. Mm-hmm. So peaceful protest doesn't work. That's what white Americans have essentially been showing for decades and decades and decades. It's only when the status quo is disrupted. And so what? So what if some buildings burn? So what if some windows are broken? So what if some cop cars are trashed? If that's what it takes to change the system. And the problem is that we don't have a countervailing force. You know, during the whole concentration camp controversy, when was that? That was 2019, I believe, or 2018. I can't even remember now.
With the separation of families, yes, 2018.
Yeah. 2018, when AOC went down and said these are concentration camps, right? And that exploded, you know, that dramatized, and you had the whole Occupy ICE movement and the Abolish ICE movement. The fact of the matter is the right wing, because I was in the thick of it, I saw like how so many right wingers supported the concentration camps. They were like, I was dealing with this in terms of Facebook, because I was moderating a large Facebook page. Hundreds of white-haired grandmothers we had to ban who were posting comments. They deserve it. They should be in those concerts. And you're talking about little brown babies being tortured, sexually assaulted, and killed. And yet we don't have this countervailing force from liberals who are saying, who cares? Who cares that the windows are broken? Who cares that these buildings are burning down? And that's because we, in this country, property is everything. And so we still have not addressed this historical issue that puts Black lives, that puts people of color lives, that puts the dispossessed lives over property rights and property relations.
Do you draw a line between the uprising around Black Lives Matter and the turnout at the election on November 3rd and even the early voting?
Well, you know, that's a complicated issue. I think it basically goes all over the place from the data that I've looked at. Certainly, a lot of people who did go to the polls said that they were voting. One of the biggest issues that were motivating people was racial justice. But you also saw that in a lot of instances, Trump's law and order campaign was turning people out. But then you also have instances, you know, let's not forget that the Democrats nearly bungled this again in the same way that Hillary Clinton did in 2016. So this is not a bug, it's a feature that the Biden campaign was an utter disaster in terms of its get out the vote. They weren't doing any door knocking. They were late in terms of opening up field offices, in terms of getting out signage. All of that could have been done. But beyond the tactical issues, we saw Biden's campaign, Biden-Harris, running away from racial justice issues. So in cities like Philadelphia, you actually saw that the black vote did not improve significantly over the black vote in 2016. But in places like Georgia, it did improve dramatically. But the thanks there goes to the, you know, years of get out the vote organizing and the registration organizing that, you know, of which Stacey Abrams is most associated with. In states like Arizona, what you saw was the effects of more than 10 years of organizing by Latino by the Latino community against English-only laws, against the racist educational laws, and that ended up about 5 years ago spilling over into LGBTQ organizing around similar bills. Then in Nevada, what really pulled it out for the Democrats was the Culinary Workers Union, which is overwhelmingly Latino. They started doing door knocking in August, 3 months before the Biden campaign. So you really have to go state by state. But on the other side, we also see evidence where the Trump's law and order didn't work, right? Because the two areas you would expect it to work the most would have been in Minneapolis and Minnesota generally. It didn't really work there. In Wisconsin, where, you know, Kenosha, where Jacob Blake was shot and paralyzed by police, it didn't really work there as well. So, you know, there is no kind of, you know, it's a complicated picture in terms of how the racial justice protests affected turnout.
Right. I mean, we have Florida as well, and there's so many interesting ways to look at it. I mean, there were certainly voter registration efforts that were part of Black Lives Matter, but and were present at many of the protests. But I think you're right that a lot of groundwork for many years went into voter turnout. And here you have an administration. I mean, there was basically a point where when it became very clear earlier this year that Biden was to be the nominee, that progressives had to face the fact that the only way out of Trumpism was through Biden. And so there was this interesting progressive liberal alliance, which was also part of the history of 2020, which will lead into 2021 as the internal battle within the Democratic Party and the Biden administration. So far, what have you seen from the Biden appointees or those people being touted? The day you and I are talking, we found out that Deb Haaland was named or will be his Interior Department Secretary pick. He seems to have placed a lot of emphasis on racial and gender diversity.
Yeah, I am not at all optimistic. I've been reporting for 30 years now, and I've seen this picture, this film, one too many times. Biden essentially is the third Obama administration without any charisma, without Obama's soaring oratorical skills, or, you know, this historic breakthrough of the first African American president. There is no hope in change. It's you know, more stay the course and keep a hand on the rudder. And the thing is, you know, Biden keeps trying to reach out to the Republicans when they are on a war footing constantly. You know, it's not even clear to me that a majority of Republicans acknowledge. A week before the Electoral College certified his victory, something like only 10% of the Republican caucus in Congress was willing to admit that Biden was the duly elected president. And, you know, and it can be different. Now, if we go back to Reagan, when he got into office, you know, the Reagan Revolution, they swept aside. It was a shocking victory because all these stalwart liberals in the Senate also lost the night that Reagan was elected. But the House was strongly Democratic. Now, Reagan kept hammering the Democrats and the Speaker, Tip O'Neill, that he had a mandate and that they had to pass the tax cuts. And they eventually did. And the Democrats were responsible for Reaganomics because it had to go through the House. Biden should be doing the same now, and yet we see nothing of the sort, absolutely hammering McConnell over, we have a disaster. More Americans have died this year than died in combat in 4 years of World War II. And I ran the numbers, three times as many Americans have died this year than were killed by Adolf Hitler in 4 years of World War II. Most Americans died in the Pacific campaign. So this is an absolute disaster, and yet we see Biden acting like everything can just return to normal. And this is why I don't think things are going to look good, because you have this essentially huge demagogic base, 70 million voters who have gone completely off the deep end. They believe in the most conspiratorial insanity whatsoever. They're completely unhinged from reality. And Trump, I am convinced he's going to run in 2024. He has such a monumental ego that he cannot stand being a loser, and he wants to do what Grover Cleveland did, the only president who was in office, lost, and then was able to be reelected again. And Trump is not going to give up his power because it's the only thing he has left.
So let's then end our conversation on what is to become of Trumpism. What is the future of Trumpism? Right now, the pro-Trumpers some of them seem to have pivoted from the stop the steal to vaccines are dangerous. After they already pivoted several times earlier this year, we didn't even talk about the mask refusers and their bizarre protests against the stay-at-home, shelter-in-place orders. But if 2021 is to be any better than 2020, we're going to need a massive public relations and public education campaign around the importance of vaccines. But we have to contend with the Trumpers. And, of course, the Democratic Party's every failure will be another win for a potential Trump 2024 run, with the Trumpers getting ready to bring their guy back in office. So where will Trumpism and the Trumpsters be next year?
Yeah, I think first let's define Trumpism, because we keep hearing this all the time. And there's this attitude that especially a lot of Republicans have jumped on because of the polling data, and that the fact that Trump was able to get substantial Latino support. Of course, the Democrats and many in the media discovered that there really is no such thing as a Latino community. There are all these various communities, but in some areas, Trump did make some shocking gains, such as in South Florida, such as in the Rio Grande Valley, in Texas, an area that is so poor that it's referred to as the third world of America. So there's a lot of commentators who are saying that, oh, Trumpism, it looks like it's a working class nationalist movement, but it's very important to recognize there's nothing working class about it whatsoever. Trump is not speaking to these workers as workers, as in terms of their economic interests. At most, there's a little about energy extraction, appealing to oil workers in the natural gas fracking, such as that, coal miners. But those are small parts of the economy. Trumpism, what it is really a cult. And it's only going to be centered around Trump. He can transfer that to his progeny, to his hellspawn, such as to Don Jr. or to Ivanka Trump, and that is, of course, what we see around the world, right? These nepotistic regimes like the Bhuttos in Pakistan, the Peronis in Argentina, the Assads in Syria, on and on. these kind of dictatorial, autocratic, authoritarian family rulers. But there is no real doctrine behind it, I think, other than white nationalism. But the problem more is that the conditions remain. And the Democrats keep feeding into them. Because if you don't give people a reason to vote for you, this is why Trump was able to make these big gains with Latinos in many states or specific areas, because the Democrats just want to say, like, oh, they're racist, so, you know, you'll vote for us, when it's just like, no, they want positive reasons to vote for you. What are you going to do to make their lives better? If you don't, then Trumpism can come in with his culture war appeals, with his nationalist appeals, and peel some of them off.
And in fact, what just happened around the economic relief bill that Democrats and Republicans are fighting over is that the Democrats, you know, the leaders, Pelosi and Schumer, seemed ready to cave into the Republican refusal to add stimulus payments. And it wasn't until Senator Bernie Sanders said, we're not going home until you include these stimulus payments, that those got put back in. I mean, they were ready to bend over to the wheel of the Republican Party yet again, if it, you know, were it not for the countervailing force that Sanders and his allies represent.
Yeah, I mean, time and again. But what do you expect? I mean, what is Nancy Pelosi worth? Something like $200 million, and she has her $11,000 refrigerator filled with chocolate ice cream. You know, what does she have to worry about? Chuck Schumer is also incredibly wealthy. You know, I mean, these people do not represent the working class. And you know, I think let's also realize that, you know, it's not just the right wing that has been disastrous in terms of making the coronavirus pandemic much worse. You know, it's places like Silicon Valley, you know, like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, who are forcing workers back to work. Whole Foods, you know, which is, of course, like this, like, which liberals love. Hollywood. Right. You know, there's been a lot of reporting on in terms of like how Hollywood has been forcing workers back into these dangerous conditions because they want to keep making their content. So, you know, this, I mean, it's essentially the ruling class. What else can we say, whether they're liberal, conservative, or fascistic, that has created this disaster? Because they know they're going to be fine. They have the access to the best healthcare, to the therapies, you know, to the gold-plated medical care, and they're not going to die from it.
Well, Arun, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Stay safe out there, and I will as well, and I'll see you in the new year. Thanks always for the work that you do.
Thank you. You too, Sonali.
My guest has been Arun Gupta, investigative journalist who's written for The Washington Post, The Nation, Raw Story, The Intercept, The Guardian, and Jacobin Magazine. He's also regular news correspondent for Rising Up with Sonali. We've been surveying the strange and terrifying year that was 2020, looking ahead to 2021. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.